What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Guests appear on the Smile Center Hotline. Now back to the Gabe Kuhn Show on 92.9 FM ESPN.
Back in and rolling on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. And joining me now, as he does every single Tuesday, that would be Christian Fowler. He's a senior writer and content creator for Bluff City Media. Check out our podcast, the On the Bluff Podcast, and the Believe in Bluff City Media Podcast Network. Releases every single Tuesday at noon. He is on XC Fowler BCM. Christian, how we doing, brother?
Doing good, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing well. A little bit damp outside today. It's a little nasty out, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
How was the Super Bowl for you? I wasn't quite as enjoyable as I thought. I thought we'd have a close game.
Yeah, I was actually really excited for the game itself, mainly because of what we saw 2 years ago, and I just thought it would be fun chess match between these coaches like we talked about last week, and just turned out to be, well, what was it at one point, 34-0?
So, yep, I mean, with 2 minutes left in the third quarter. It was a butt whooping.
Yeah, complete blowout. So the party and hanging out with the friends was a million times more fun than actually watching the game. So disappointing, but it gives everybody an excuse to get together and hang out, right? I mean, that's the best part of it.
Of course. But I will say this, like, we did witness history in the fact that I think we have a couple of guys that are stamped now. Jalen Hurts, quarterback for the Eagles, and then the head coach for the Eagles, Nick Sirianni. Two guys that I think have been much maligned at certain points throughout their career. Jalen Hurts gets a bad rap for maybe not being able to throw the ball the best, but he definitely put it all together in this game. And then Nick Sirianni, I mean, this was, what was it, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, we're talking about this guy potentially being fired. Because the end of the season last year was nasty. The beginning of the season this year did not go according to plan, but they turned it on and they made some things happen, and Nick Sirianni was a big reason that was the case.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look back on specifically those two guys, like you talked about with Nick Sirianni and Jalen Hurts, because, the beginning of the season, the Eagles are 2-2. Nick Sirianni's cussing out fans, and people are, and really Philadelphia fans too, were tired of him and calling for him to be gone and that it was unacceptable, you know, with the amount of talent that he had to collapse at the end of the 23 season, and then to start this season off 2-2, and then he just completely turned it around. And I gave him a lot of flowers and a lot of credit on here last week, just for the way that the last 14-15 months has gone, to have a team that's sitting at 10-1, and you know, one of the favorites to go to the Super Bowl in the conference, and then just completely fall apart down the stretch. I think it was like they lost 5 of their last 6, or they lost 6 in a row. It was rough to end the season last year. And then they got blown out by the Bucks in the wild card round, which on paper, that Philadelphia team was much better than that Tampa team. But to go through that, to have all the rumors that were swirling about he and Jalen Hurts in the front office and everybody being on different pages, and then to start this year 2-2, clearly frustrated, the way that he ended the season is, it's incredible. They did not lose a game from October 1st until obviously now, still have not lost a game that Jalen Hurts has started and finished. Not a single game did they lose since, I think that was week 4, after they lost to, coincidentally, the Buccaneers again. So the way that he rallied the locker room, the additions that he made in the offseason, whether that was, you know, bringing in Zach Bond, bringing in Vic Fangio, drafting Quinyon Mitchell, drafting Cooper DeJean. I know that's obviously all in collaboration with the front office as well. But he just did an incredible job of getting that thing back on the rails. Because typically, and I think I said this last week, but typically when you have so much drama surrounding a team, it's over. And I think most people towards the end of last year were like, okay, this Nick Sirianni experiment might make it through this year. You know, like it felt like he was on borrowed time and that his clock was ticking because of the way that last year ended. And then to go all the way to the Super Bowl, dominate in it, is extremely impressive. And then with Jalen Hurts, that is a quarterback that's been doubted his entire career. I mean, he comes into Alabama, he gets benched for Tua in the national championship game, transfers to Oklahoma, had an incredible end of his career in Oklahoma. A lot of people weren't sure about him, didn't know if he could throw the ball at the NFL level. Proved people wrong. It took him a couple years to really hit his stride, but in his second season with Shane Steichen, the last time the Eagles went to the Super Bowl, he had the best season of his career. And he's one of the winningest quarterbacks over the last 3 or 4 years, and now he's a Super Bowl champion. So there's not much that you can take away from him. And to me, the biggest stamp that you can give him is that we talk about how great Joe Burrow and Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson are.
Sure.
But none of those guys have ever won Super Bowls. And the reason we kind of put an asterisk next to it and give them a little bit of an out, because we say they have to go against Patrick Mahomes and they can't beat Patrick Mahomes. Jalen Hurts did just that. He went to the Super Bowl against, you know, one of the best two quarterbacks of all time and outdueled him the entire game. So, yeah, you're right. Both of those guys, after a lot of ups and downs and controversy, they're stamped after that one.
Now, we had a bit of a conversation about this on the pod, and I want to bring it to the show. The Chiefs, after a loss like that in the Super Bowl, Is there a level of this where you sort of need to get back to the drawing board and decide what you want to do, how you want to go about things going into the future? Because this was not a normal Chiefs team. Very good on defense, really good there. But they lacked a lot of explosivity on offense. It didn't feel like they really fed Patrick Mahomes' skill set as much as they have in the past. Like, what do you think the Chiefs need to do to get back to this point?
I think they've got to go back to the explosives. I think the way that I phrased it last night is it's like having the best card in your hand out of the entire deck and not playing it and just, you know, holding it and keeping it close to your chest and never playing it. And I get it. They want to limit turnovers, and the offense didn't look the way that they expected it to this year because Rashee Rice got hurt and Hollywood Brown got hurt.
Sure.
But Patrick Mahomes, yeah, I mean, he's incredible at a lot of things, but like at the end of the day, he's a gunslinger. Like, that is what he is. He's made in the same mold as like Brett Favre and Matt Stafford and these guys that just go out there and sling it. Obviously better than those guys, but have we ever really seen those guys get the reins put on them and say, all right, let's dink and dunk and stay around the line of scrimmage and take care of the ball and let the defense win the game? And I get that. I mean, it's a strategy to be able to let your defense win the game, run clock, and take advantage when the other team makes mistakes. I get it, but you have, in my opinion, the most talented football player of all time. Like, why are we playing in one-score games every week? I mean, yes, the defense is good, and they weren't as good this year as last year, but they're still a solid defense. So why not let Patrick Mahomes do his thing on offense and just blow teams out the door? Like, there's no need to play this conservative, stay away from turnover, time of possession style of football when you have a guy who can literally win you a game in 13 seconds, which we've seen before.
Right.
Like, he is the most explosive quarterback in the league. There's nobody that's better at making big plays than Patrick Mahomes. And it feels like the last 2 years they've, like, put training wheels on him and said, okay, just take care of the ball. I don't see – if he throws 47 touchdowns and 13, 14 interceptions, who cares?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, he's fully capable of throwing 45-plus touchdowns every year. He's totally capable of doing exactly what Joe Burrow is doing in Cincinnati. And I know – I get it. They were 15-1 in games that the starters played in. Obviously, they sat him in Week 18. They won a lot of games. They ran through the playoffs. They made it to another Super Bowl. But the lack of explosiveness is really what held them back. Obviously, the offensive line as well.
Sure.
But just feeling so stagnant and not making a defense feel threatened. And that's okay if you're playing a not great defense. But if you're playing a defense like the Philadelphia Eagles and they don't feel threatened, everybody's going to have their ears pinned back flying to the ball at all times. And they're not saying, you're not making them think. You're not making them think, can it go over my head or is it going to go here? They know everything's going to be within 10 to 15 yards and they can stop your running game and they can get after Patrick Mahomes. And that's exactly what they did. So I understand some of the reasons I think they've done the things that they've done over the last couple of years. But it's time to go back in the direction of the 2017, 18, 19, 20, those seasons. When we saw Patrick Mahomes win two MVPs and have at least two, just incredible seasons where he's throwing for 5,000 yards and nearing 50 touchdowns. Like, that's what he is made to do, and that's how he's going to win you games.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, we saw it at the end of the game. Here's Xavier Worthy running his 4-2 on a deep post, deep skinny post over the top, and he drops it into a bucket, Patrick Mahomes does, over two defenders. You know what I mean? Like, he can still do those things. It just feels like that's become few and far in between. So this is the real question. How do they facilitate, making that happen? Obviously, it has to do with offensive play calling, offensive game planning. I am of the opinion, you look at, like, their wide receiver room, maybe add to that, or at least get Rashee Rice back healthy and ready to go and playing. Like, what do they do to facilitate getting back to their old ways offensively?
Protect their quarterback. That's the biggest thing.
Wouldn't it?
I mean, the last time that the Chiefs lost like this in the Super Bowl was to the Bucs, and I'm going all off memory here, so I might be incorrect. But I think they fully turned their offensive line over that next year. That might have been the same time they drafted Creed Humphrey and Trey Smith and brought in Joe Tooney.
Yeah, that year they had two old tackles, Mitchell Schwartz and Eric Fisher, that were both hurt going into the Super Bowl. So they had to kick everybody around.
Right, and start bringing new people in. But I think the year after he lost the Super Bowl, that was his second best year outside of his first season, if I'm not mistaken, because they retooled that offensive line and they just started letting them chunk it again.
Right.
And so I think the offensive line is extremely important, because if you're going to make plays down the field, if you're going to have enough time to allow those guys to get open and make plays, you have to be protected. And they masked a lot of those issues this year. And I think that's another reason why we saw it be so conservative, is because they knew they didn't have the tackles to hold up to allow Patrick Mahomes to get receivers down the field and make plays down the field. So I think they got to fix up front, and you could have a big hole at right guard. Trey Smith's a free agent. Do they drop the money and sign him? You obviously want to keep those three interior guys and Trey Smith, Creed Humphrey, and Joe Tooney, but you have to get tackles as well. Like, Jawan Taylor is not the answer. Taylor is not the answer at right tackle. There are other options that need to be explored. So I think it starts with protecting him, and then as well, like, I'm not going to be upset if they go get somebody else. Like, I think Rashee Rice and Xavier Worthy and Travis Kelce, if he ends up coming back, like, I think that's perfectly fine as a receiving core. But if they really just want to go scorched earth, like, go get two tackles, go get another receiver, and just hang 40 on everybody.
Right.
Because they're fully capable of it. I mean, you look at the backfield, they still got Pacheco, and he should be much better next year after coming off the weird injury and stuff like that. Like, this this just wasn't the year that it was supposed to be for him, and that's why he was largely ineffective down the stretch. I mean, he broke his leg early in the season, and that takes time to get right from. So he'll be back. You'll have at least Xavier Worthy and Rashee Rice back. Go get another weapon. Don't worry about bringing back DeAndre Hopkins or Hollywood Brown. Go get another weapon, whether it's in the draft or free agency. Fix the tackle situation and just let it fly next year.
Yeah. Now, I know that everybody wants to do the Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes legacy talk. We want to revisit it after every single Super Bowl the guy plays in. So you go ahead and holler at me. Where are we at with the Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes back and forth? Who has the better legacy? Who's going to have the better legacy? I've always tried to avoid this thing because I think it's a little overplayed, because Tom Brady played until he was 45 years old, and Patrick Mahomes is still 29. Like, he's not even 30 yet. So I think it's just, you know, we're jumping the gun on all these things. But where are you at in that particular conversation?
I mean, I think if you look at this point in both of their careers, like, obviously Patrick Mahomes, in my opinion, is ahead of where Brady was. I know all the numbers are pretty similar as far as, like, legacy things, as wins, playoff wins, Super Bowl, all that's pretty close. Obviously, Patrick's stats are a little bit inflated just because of the day and age he plays in versus Brady. But just looking at raw numbers, like, you would say Patrick Mahomes is ahead of Tom Brady at this point in their respective careers. But Brady went on to play 15 more years.
Right. Yeah, of course,
like,
yes.
That's what you're alluding to. Like, it's so hard to compare because, yeah, if you extrapolate Patrick Mahomes' numbers until he's 45, of course he's going to be better than Tom Brady. But that just doesn't happen. It's happened one time. Like, Brady is the only quarterback that's been able to play that far into his 40s and be as effective as he was. I mean, winning a Super Bowl at whatever it was, 42 or 43, and having nearly 5,000 yards and 40 touchdowns, like, that is unheard of, and we know that. So you would have to say Patrick Mahomes would have to stick around for – at least 13 more years to get around those numbers. I'm with you. I think it's a very difficult argument to have because, like I said, Patrick, in my opinion, is the best player to ever play. He's not the greatest. That's Tom Brady, because the greatest is, we're talking about accomplishments and legacy. But it's just it's a tall mountain to climb, and he's climbed it quicker than anybody
else.
Sure. But can he maintain? Can he sustain this? Can he do what Brady did and have that late career resurgence? Because we know Brady went 10 years without winning a Super Bowl. I mean, he went from 04 to 14. So that would have been from the Eagles Super Bowl to the – what Super Bowl was that? The Seahawks Super Bowl.
Yep.
So 10 years with two losses in there, both to the Giants, like, before he won another one. Yep. And this one, I don't think this hurts Mahomes' legacy as much as people are saying, but – If you would have done the three-peat, if you had been 4-1 in Super Bowls at age 29, like, we probably would have projected a little bit more that, like, yeah, he's gonna beat Brady. Like, he's already got four.
Yeah.
He's not even 30. He has the only three-peat of all time. It looks like he's going to catch up. But this is a big one. I mean, to be 3-2 rather than 4-1 with a three-peat is a big legacy talk point. So I think there's still a long way to go. We'll see how long he actually wants to play, how long he's effective. But, like, if you're going to make a bet on anybody in NFL history to ever do what Brady did, Mahomes is clearly and obviously the only guy.
Yes. The reason – I think you sort of hit on the reasons I don't necessarily like the debate at this particular moment, because you have to find contextual similarities, and there's just not a lot.
Right.
Because, like, when Tom Brady started playing, we're talking about the early 2000s, he's handing the ball off, dumping it down to Kevin Falk, and – I mean, he had one wide receiver for a long time in Deion Branch, and obviously they started to open it up once they got Randy Moss and, you know, Wes Welker, Julian Edelman came along. There's a lot of different things that happened, but he went through a shift in football completely.
Right.
By the time he got to the 2010s. And Patrick Mahomes came to the league in 2017, and that's what football was at that particular moment. We're pass happy. You just have to find these contextual similarities that aren't there, and it's just frustrating to see this debate always revisited every single year when Patrick Mahomes wins or loses a Super Bowl.
Yeah, and it's one thing to have the discussion and have the debate, But people don't put that context in there. And
right.
I think that's what's aggravating to me. It's just on face value, like who's better, who's going to be the GOAT. Like, it's just that. It's not let's really dig deep
Again, nuance. It's losing nuance. It's how we talk about sports. We don't like nuance as much as we once did.
No, not at all. And it's the same reason that think about this. Like for me and you, for our generation, it was so hard to picture Brady and Montana. Like we did not have the context to do that. Like when people would say, we would say when we were kids, like Tom Brady's the best quarterback, and all of our parents would say, no, it's Joe Montana. We didn't have the context to do that because we weren't watching football back then. And so for these two guys to come so much closer together, I think it should be an easier connection for us to contextualize it and say, look, you know, we were watching football in 2004 and it was this, and in 2017 to now it's this. But it doesn't happen, and I don't understand why. Like I feel like people give you more context between the 80s and the 2000s when it comes to the Montana Brady debate of what it was back in those days than you get now with Mahomes and Brady, and we've seen these guys on the same field. I don't know. It's just I don't understand why when we have these debates and when we have these conversations, we can't parse through everything and get to the nuanced points and operate a little bit more in the gray area rather than the black and white, because it's not a black and white argument.
Sure.
It's a very difficult, nuanced conversation when we're talking about legacy between any players. I would argue that it's one of the hardest things to debate in sports is legacy versus legacy. I mean, the Michael Jordan, LeBron James debate is massive, and you still can't get a lot of people that will actually contextualize it and operate in the gray area because it's just black and white. It's either him or him, and I feel like it's going to be.
And it's about what you value more too. How much do you value longevity?
Correct.
Because LeBron James has that longevity, Tom Brady has that longevity, and it's hard to imagine anybody else getting to that Tom Brady longevity, even with
right.
you know what Patrick Mahomes has been able to do through the first 7 years of his career as a starter.
Yeah, no, but I think you make a great point though. Like we're going to have this debate for a long time. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. So like, let's be more open to contextualizing it and operating in the gray area. And I know a lot of it is because it's sports talk and it's,
sure.
you know, sports
pick
TV
a side,
and sports radio,
let's debate.
We got to pick a side and say crazy things, but I don't know on something like this, like let's just, really, if we're going to talk about it, if we're going to discuss it, like let's get into the weeds, which I know me and you enjoy that because that's the most fun thing that we can possibly do when talking about sports for us. Like, let's really get into it. Let's get some crazy stats and let's put
right.
everything in the context. But I think it's necessary when you're having legacy debates. There are some, you know, stupid debates that you can have or whatever. But when you're talking legacy and you're talking greatness, like you got to sit down and really get into it, in my opinion.
Now, let me bring this up, though, because this is something you get a lot of. Half of Patrick Mahomes' playoff losses are to Tom Brady. One when the AFC
yeah.
Championship when he was with the Patriots, and then, of course, the Super Bowl with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Like, how much does that matter? And obviously, I'm talking about half. He's only got four. I mean, he's 17-4 in the playoffs. That's absolutely ridiculous. But,
right.
like, how much is that going to mean? How much does that mean? And, like, is there a hump you have to get over to make that null and void? Like, that's something I've actually struggled with when people ask me and pose that to me.
Yeah, that makes it all the more tough. And I was actually thinking about that the other day, too, when it was like, okay, Mahomes has four playoff losses, one in his first season to Brady in the AFC Championship game. And if you don't, I'm going to say this right now. If you haven't seen that game or don't remember that game, like go back and watch it. That is one of, in my opinion, the best games of like the last 20 years. But anyway, and then you have him beating him in the Super Bowl a couple years later when he goes to Tampa. And that's a big hurdle to get over when you're – if someone eventually, let's say it is razor close between Mahomes and Brady, and you're making that argument, it's almost like a king to just
right.
be able to say, okay, all these things are great, and there's all these points and all these topics, but Brady won the head-to-head.
We value head-to-head. We value head-to-head in this society.
We do value head-to-head, and I don't know. I think the only thing about that is it's just like you go back to that Patriots and Chiefs game in the AFC Championship game, and I know the Patriots won, but like Patrick Mahomes was impeccable in that game.
Sure.
I don't know how well you remember, but he was perfect in that game. It's kind of like the grace that we give for Josh Allen in the games that he's played against Patrick Mahomes. It's like he did everything that he could, but his defense let him down. And that's kind of what happened in that AFC Championship game. Now, the Super Bowl, you can't even argue that one. The Bucs just destroyed the Chiefs in that game.
And there were reasons for that. Patrick Mahomes didn't have an offensive line.
Yeah, no, there definitely were. But it's just like, I don't know. I think for most people, honestly, like if it does get razor thin between the two, I think that's always going to kind of be the trump card. Like that's always going to be the thing that probably gets Tom Brady over the top of Mahomes is that he beat him in a Super Bowl and he beat him in an AFC Championship game. And that's hard to get over.
And let's not forget the AFC Championship game went a long way to changing overtime rules. Let's not forget what the conversation that game spurred that ultimately made changes to the OT rules that ultimately helped Patrick Mahomes later in his career. So I think that's another bit of added context that needs to be discussed. All right, now let's get to Tigers basketball. 20-4, first time they've won 20 in 25 games since 2013. They have South Florida coming up on Thursday. Tyrese Hunter is a game time decision. Still sort of wondering what's going on with him, and it seems like an injury of some sort. Here's my question. I just want to pose this to you. With Tyrese Hunter and the way that Dante Harris filled in, is there any reason to rush Tyrese Hunter back? If Tyrese Hunter needs to take a couple more games off, do you think that should be necessary? Just go ahead and let him.
That's exactly what was going through my mind when you were saying game time decision. It's like, just let him be fully healthy. Like, let him get fully healthy with the way that Dante Harris played, with the way that P.J. Carter's been playing, with the way that P.J. Haggerty and Dane Danger have been leading the charge, and combat that with the teams that Memphis is playing. If they were playing this great schedule and they had must-win games coming up, then if he's 80-20 or if he's 80% or something like that, then you probably play him because you need to win that game. But Memphis doesn't need Tyrese Hunter to win these games. And that's not a knock against Tyrese Hunter. That's a knock against the teams that Memphis is playing. So obviously you want him to be out there. Obviously you are a better team with him out there. But just wait until he gets fully healthy. You have 7 regular season games left before the conference tournament. You're favored pretty heavily in every single one of them. If he needs 3 or 4 games, like give him 3 or 4 games. Let him get fully healthy. Let these other guys who have been impressive off the bench and filling in do their thing. And let Tyrese be 100% when he comes back.
Yes, I think I'm with you there. I think I'm with you there. Dante Harris filled in, had 14 points, 6 for 8 from the field, no turnovers. I think that's a guy that you can trust in the starting lineup for a second while Tyrese Hunter gets himself back to health. I don't think, you know, with 7 games left, there's only one game that you sort of circle as a quote-unquote scary, and I guess that's at UAB on March 2nd. You know, because like at South Florida, at Wichita State, sure, you're on the road, but neither of those teams scare you. FAU, Rice, then you'll have that UAB game. And that UAB game is the one you circle as, okay, we need to be full strength here.
Right. And I mean, like you said, quote unquote, scary. Like it's not really scary. Like, it's a game.
You beat them by 23 at home. Like you've seen what you can do to that team at home. Obviously on the road, different animal, but you've seen that you can beat that team handily.
Yeah, and then obviously you want him back for that game, but it's like, do you have to have him to win that game? Probably not. UAB will probably be extremely hyped up for that game after the way that Memphis handled him at the FedEx Forum, but you probably don't. And I think that's the second to last game of the year, so you still have 5 more games before you get there. So it's like, if he's a game-time decision now, you would imagine he'd be pretty close to 100% by the time that March 2nd game against UAB rolls around. So there's nothing scary on the schedule. There's no team that Memphis shouldn't be able to beat without Tyrese Hunter in the lineup. So I get what you're saying. Like, that's the toughest game left. But even that game is a game you can win. But hopefully he is 100% by then and ready to go, and gets those 2 games to kind of gear up for the conference tournament.
Yeah. Now, last thing I want to bring up, the difference between the reality of what the Tigers have accomplished and their metrics. I know last year I had this discussion about Bartorvik and Net and where they KenPom and where the Tigers are ranked as opposed to what they did in the out-of-conference. Now, last year that came back and bit me in the butt because most of those out-of-conference wins did not age as well as this year, and I think there was a little bit of fool's gold with the out-of-conference slate that they played last year. But this year, right, it feels like these predictive metrics are waiting on the Tigers' fall that's not actually happening. And to me, that's frustrating. And I just don't understand. Like, you just look at some of these metrics. Bartorvik, they're 52nd. Net, they're 45th. And there's teams like, you know, Ohio State and a team they beat in UConn ahead of them. And SMU, who is potentially out of the tournament. They're at least on the bubble right now, according to most bracketologists. I just don't quite understand. And I never quite have fully grasped on to the predictive metrics and the metrics in general. I think that the resume tells a story that the metrics don't.
Yeah, I just, honestly, I don't pay as much attention to it. And I know a lot of people do because it's just another thing where you can see what
it updates every night and you're in you. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's impossible for some fans not to check and look and see where Memphis is at. But to me, like, I just don't pay attention to it. I don't put that much stock into it. And I think there are some things that they're right on. Like, there are some teams and there are some metrics where if you go look at the predictive metrics, you go, huh, that makes sense now. Like, I didn't – maybe some stats didn't point to them being one of the best defense teams in the country, but then you go look and you get their full spread of metrics and you go, okay, so some stats do show that. So I think there's benefits for it, but I think they're few and far between. Like, I don't know. I don't put much stock into it. I don't think – it's extremely accurate, and so it just doesn't mean that much to me because we've seen this with Memphis before. We saw it last year, and ultimately they were right, but, like, it didn't make sense at the time why Memphis was ranked as low as they were before the bottom fell out, and this year it's even worse because you look at – I think we talked about this last night. Memphis has, like, a top 10 resume in the entire country. I mean, they beat – a ton of really good – beat Ole Miss, UConn, Michigan State, a loss to the number one team in the country. Like, they've been extremely impressive. You take two games away. You take Arkansas State and Temple out, which Memphis just avenged over the weekend. Like, it's been one of the best schedules in the entire country.
Right.
So it's hard to look at the body of work and what they've done and the teams they've beaten and the players that they have on the roster and their metrics and make sense of it because it doesn't. And I know people really didn't pay that much attention to this stuff until, you know, they said that the Net rankings factored in. And I know that changed some people's opinion on it, but it used to be just, oh, this team is so-and-so in KenPom.
Who did you beat? What did it look like? You know, who did you lose to? Who are your good wins and your bad losses? And then we see.
Right. Right. And that was it. And KenPom has been popular, but nobody put that much stock. You know, it was like, oh, this team is ranked so-and-so in KenPom. And it was just like, okay, whatever that means. I have no idea.
Right.
But then it's like you get Bartorvik rankings and you get the Net rankings and you see that the committee is putting stock into the Net rankings and that it matters. And it's just become, to me, way bigger than it actually is.
Like, I'm with you.
It's not for me.
I hear you.
And that's coming from a guy that loves stats. Like, I'm not a stat
right.
hater at all. I'm a stat guy, but I don't know. I don't put that much stock.
Yeah, stats and analytics are just becoming more in every single sport that we watch, and I think this is just another example of that. And they don't tell the whole story. They never really have statistics. So we'll see how it all plays out. I would assume that the resume by the end of the year will mean more than their Net ranking, their KenPom ranking, and their Bartorvik ranking. But we'll see how it works. But Christian, I appreciate it, man. We'll do it again next week.
Yes, sir. I'll see y'all next week.
He is Christian Fowler at C Fowler BCM, senior writer and content creator for Bluff City Media. Now it's time to get into the Blitz. And did the Mavs upset the basketball gods? I'll answer that question next.
Now, the biggest stories. Overloading the line. A bull rush of info. It's Gabe's Blitz on the Gabe Kuhn Show on 92.9 FM ESPN, Memphis' sports station.
And the Blitz on the Gabe Kuhn Show is brought to you by Sissy's Log Cabin. Connor, what we got?
Daniel Gafford hurt his knee last night with a hyperextension, and he's going to require imaging.
Okay, so I'm going to answer the question that I posed before we went to break. Have the Mavs angered the basketball gods by trading away 25-year-old Luka Doncic? I think it's an absolute yes. I know that sounds a little bit corny, but we have AD going down immediately. Derek Lively has been out for some time, and now Daniel Gafford has a hyperextended knee. And in the best-case scenario, he'll be out for some weeks with a hyperextended knee. Worst-case scenario, we're talking about ligament damage, ACL, MCL, PCL, whatever it is, and he may be out for the remainder of the season. So they have no bigs now. Who else are they turning to at this particular moment? You traded Luka for a guy who was oft injured. You could have predicted he was going to get injured, AD. You got it all in one game. You got the whole AD experience in one game. But you traded Luka for that guy. He goes down. You just have nothing you can rely on now. You thought this was going to be a win-now trade, and now I don't think you're going to do a whole lot of winning with all these guys on the shelf. And I'll say this. Even more so than the injuries, I hate the way the Mavericks are conducting themselves right now, Connor. If you have been paying attention to all of the hoopla around the Luka trade and how the fans are reacting and what's going on in American Airlines Center, it's very sad to see this Mavericks organization just crumble with all the pressure. There was fans who had Fire Nico signs that got ejected from the game, got sent out of the game. They paid for their tickets. Yet they had Fire Nico signs, and the Mavs decided to let them go. Freedom of speech, freedom of expression, I thought, but I guess they don't want to hear bad things about themselves. That's pretty embarrassing. You had Jason Kidd. He didn't speak postgame. He didn't want to speak postgame.
Because he was going to cuss out Nico.
He's frustrated.
I think he was probably going to cuss out Nico.
Anthony Davis, the injury happened not too long ago, but at the same time, I figured at this point we'd have an update. No update there. Dirk Nowitzki. Made it very clear he's closer to Luka than he is with the Mavs front office at this moment. He went to L.A. for Luka's debut against the Utah Jazz. By the way, the Lakers absolutely, they look dominant offensively. So many open shots. Luka had 14 points. And they scored, what, almost nearly 130?
I think they had 132.
Yeah, they had 132 points.
Maybe 134.
And I know the Jazz stink, but 132 points
the
against anybody's.
The Jazz are dog water. The shots were
good.
Open. Yeah.
I just look at that Mavs organization. They're in complete free fall. And you have fans that have sold their season tickets. You have legends that are not wanting to follow them right now because of the trade they made. And you have a front office that made this trade, and it's not respecting the blowback that they're getting, even though you should have expected a whole bunch of blowback from trading a superstar, a transcendent superstar like Luka Doncic. So I just hate the way the Mavs are trending, sure, but I hate the way that they're acting right now through this tough time.
I genuinely feel terrible for their fans.
Yes, 100%.
This has all happened in a week. The Mavs traded Luka Doncic. Anthony Davis had a potential season-ending injury. Gafford hurt his knee. And now the Mavericks don't have every single big man on their roster. AD, Lively, Gafford, PJ Washington, and Powell. And Nico is kicking fans out because they're pissed off and should be pissed off. Listen, man, if you're going to do a trade like this, you got to be 10 toes down.
Yes.
You went in that presser saying, oh, well, you know, it's going to look like I was right when they start winning basketball games. When's that going to start? You said you were trading for a defensive team, and then you gave up a game-winning shot to DeMar DeRozan and like 120-plus points. Where's that defense, Nico? Jason Kidd, I understand why he doesn't want to speak to the media because he probably only has bad things to say right now because his front office completely dismantled a contending basketball
team.
Yes,
they did.
The face of your franchise, Dirk Nowitzki, the legend of your franchise, the best player you've ever had.
He's not showing up to your game. He's going to L.A.
He went to L.A. to watch Luka. That is a statement right there. That's the biggest statement he could have possibly made, was going to support Luka last night. It has got to be heart-wrenching for Dallas Mavericks fans right now. And this is the type of thing that can ruin fandom.
Yes.
It can destroy your fan base. Because not only did you do something that every single fan disagrees with, you're now kicking them out for being upset about it.
Yep.
Grow up, Nico. Honestly, the Mavericks need to grow up.
You say destroy fandom. It can destroy their franchise. I think it's really on the way to doing that.
They you know, when they made the trade, sure, you figured that this was a path that we could go down, but it's happening way quicker than I expected. You know what I mean? Like, that's frustrating. So I do think, you know, and I hate to sort of poke fun and have fun at the expense of the Dallas Mavericks and the Dallas Mavericks fan, because I really feel bad for them, but that front office definitely pissed off the basketball gods. They are not in their favor right now.
Yeah, I'm not poking fun at the fans at all. I genuinely feel bad for them. You know, to be honest, this is a great thing for the Grizzlies, though. Nico single-handedly dismembered a contending basketball team.
One of the teams that could really push the Grizzlies in the playoff series.
Yeah, and this is exactly what we thought was going to happen. When they made the trade for Anthony Davis, all of us said, if he stays healthy. And Trevor Lane said it yesterday on the show. Yeah, AD's had a couple years of health here, but there's always that risk. And it took four quarters for Anthony Davis's body to explode
in
Dallas.
Honestly, it was 1 year of good health. It was last
year. It was really one full year.
76 games he played in. The year before that, it was like 50-some-odd, 56, something like that. It's not like there's this long-running track of 4 years he's put together where he's been off the injured list. He has consistently been on the injured list.
And just to add insult to injury, having to watch Luka last night smile when he looked up on fast breaks and saw LeBron James running down the court, Mavericks fans had to be like, oh my God, Parquet!
Yes.
Parquet! Have you seen that game?
I have not.
You haven't seen Montoya?
No.
You don't know what's going on with Montoya?
Explain it to me.
Parquet!
His girl cheated on him on a reality show.
He ran through waves and lightning to get to her. That's what Mavericks fans are doing right now. They're running across the country. Parquet, Luka!
Yeah, but the Lakers, I just want to throw this out there. Their starting lineup last night, 21 points for Rui, 24 for LeBron, 12 for Jackson Hayes, 22 for Austin Reeves, 14 for Luka Doncic.
Well, and here's the problem. Yes, again, they were playing the Jazz.
But honestly, still, they maximized everybody in that starting lineup.
Yeah, and Luka is clearly not 100% yet. You could tell he was moving differently. His shots weren't knocking down. He had some rust on him. The issue is you are going to have to decide either we double Luka and leave LeBron open, or we double LeBron and leave Luka open, or we allow our defenders to defend them one-on-one and probably get cooked. But even if you double one of them and then you help over to the other guy, you're going to leave somebody like Rui Hachimura or Austin Reeves open,
exactly,
who are having the best seasons of their careers.
And this is one thing that J.J. Redick and LeBron James, when they were still doing their podcast, before J.J. Redick was ever even in the running to be the Lakers head coach, they talked about guys in the league who you can't really double-team because they'll always make the right play.
Right.
There's two players that they brought up in that conversation. LeBron James and Luka Doncic. You have to pick your poison. And more often than not, you're going to opt against double teaming those guys, because if you double team somebody, it's a fact of history. Somebody else is going to be open, and those guys know how to find them. So just the thinking back to the Mavs just gift wrapping this title-contending team to the Lakers. Obviously, they still need a big. I'm there with you. But they're still a terrifying team because you have LeBron James and Luka.
God, Nico, you're so stupid. How do you still have a job?
I don't know.
Brandon Ingram signed a 3-year, $120 million extension with the Raptors.
Okay, listen, I don't think the Raptors are scary in any way, shape, or form. They have basically really good third options all paired on a team together.
Yep.
Right, Scotty Barnes, R.J. Barrett, Brandon Ingram, Jakob Poeltl.
Emmanuel Quickly.
Yeah, like you just have a bunch of really good third offensive options on one team. Maybe they could be a play-in team going forward. Not this year. They're just way too much. They've built themselves such a deficit. It's just going to be hard.
They had a lot of injuries this year.
Dig themselves out of that hole.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I don't mind them giving him this deal. You know, I think Brandon Ingram's good enough. He's a 20-point-per-game scorer in his career. I think it makes some sense. It's not a Jimmy Butler deal where he's getting $60 million a year.
Ugh.
Somewhere around $40 million. Like, that's what he is going to get. So I know that people have turned away from thinking Brandon Ingram is a great player or a winning player. He's never been in a winning situation. But this type of deal doesn't really bother me all that much in the end of the day. Again, don't think it's going to help the Raptors long-term be some viable contender, but, hey, It is what it is. I don't think every move or every signing has to have that in mind.
They'll be competitive. They'll be competitive. And Toronto has talked about for a very long time how it is difficult for them to get free agents. So getting a talent like Brandon Ingram is something that is important to them. So go ahead and lock him up. I don't dislike the contract that much either. $40 million a year from Brandon Ingram is a little bit more than I would pay.
Sure.
But I understand it if you're the Toronto Raptors. They were willing to go into the tax form. That core is interesting. And you pointed out before we got on the show, he is just younger than you think
he
is.
Yeah, he's 27 years old. He's not some guy that's well into his 30s.
Right.
So not Jimmy Butler at 35 years old getting $60 million.
Maybe the Canadian heir will unlock something within Brandon Ingram.
One thing I will say about
the
situation he's in now, at least he's going to get his opportunities.
Right.
You know, the Pelicans were trying to take away opportunities at every turn from Brandon Ingram. At least the Raptors want to give him his chances to go score the basketball and be the player he is.
Right.
So, at the end of the day, I don't mind this at all. I think it's a fine contract. Not what I would pay Brandon Ingram, but we'll see how it works out for the Toronto Raptors.
Now, I guess the issue is the Raptors' best player, RJ Barrett, does play the exact same position as Brandon Ingram, so they'll have to figure that out. But I would have to guess one of them could probably slide to shooting guard if need be.
You have so much scoring in the starting lineup, you almost want to just like, okay, let's put one of you to the bench and make you like a
Brandon Ingram
man
off the bench would be interesting.
We've been calling that for a while, whether it was the Pelicans or whatever. I mean, it's going to make sense. But you have so much on-ball, ISO scoring in that starting lineup that it's like just maybe move one of those guys to the bench to free up a little bit and focus on defense, lifting up
The defense is the issue.
Yeah, so I will see what they do going forward. But I know that everybody's first reaction when you see Brandon Ingram get a contract like this is to completely hate on it. But it's fine. Don't feel that way. I don't think this is that bad of a deal by any stretch of the imagination. It is a relatively big deal for Brandon Ingram, considering what he was not with the New Orleans Pelicans, but I think it's a different role altogether, and they'll find better ways to get him involved with the team than the Pelicans ever did.
Mm-hmm.
But that will do it for the Blitz. One more segment left in the day, and we'll rewind when we return right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN.